00-0944, Karen. And how is the name pronounced? Yokera or Yoshira? Yoker. Versus Farmers Insurance Exchange. Douglas Carroll, representing Farmers Insurance Exchange, will argue the case.
Thank you, Justice. I'm Douglas Carroll. I represent the petitioner, Farmers Insurance Exchange. I'd like to thank the court for accepting this petition. I think the facts here are fairly short and simple. I just want to take a minute to go through them quickly, and then I'd like to get into the policy issues in this case. I don't think they've been addressed previously in any reported decision. This is a UIM case. It does involve a statute of limitations issue. The accident occurred on October 22, back in 1987. The action was not commenced on this UIM policy, however, until May 16, 1997. That was over 9.5 years after the accident. There's a 6-year statute of limitations, 893.43. The statute of limitations requires that an action be commenced within the time limited by law, meaning the filing of a summons and complaint, and service within the appropriate number of days thereafter of an authenticated copy. In this case, the definition of an underinsured motor vehicle compares limits to limits. You compare the limits of the liability policy of the tortfeasor to the UIM limits. In this case, there were two tortfeasors, Mr. Barnes and Ms. Noyes. Each one of them had a $50,000 liability limit policy. Mr. Barnes was also coincidentally insured by Farmers Insurance Exchange on a liability policy, and Ms. Noyes was insured by American Family. The law of joint and several liability at the time indicated that if you were 1% causally negligent, you were on the hook for 100% of the damages. The significance of that is that the claimant could have made a UIM claim against either Mr. Barnes or Ms. Noyes or both of them, and they could have sued one for 100% of the damages on the UIM policy. The UIM limit was $250,000, and I believe there were two policies that were in the record. There's a claim of a third policy. I don't believe there's anything in the record that substantiates that. The claimants here did file their complaint within the 3-year statute of limitations on their tort claim. Not only that, when they first filed it, it was only against Mr. Barnes and his insurer, Farmers. The complaint specifically alleged that the plaintiff's damages at that time, within 3 years after the accident, exceeded $100,000. Therefore, they exceeded the $50,000 limits of Mr. Barnes, and they exceeded the total liability limits of both tortfeasors. Plaintiff alleged that. We all know what the statute requires about counsel signing pleadings. That means there's a good faith basis to make that claim. They then amended the complaint and added Ms. Noyes and American Family, and they again alleged the damages exceeded $100,000, both liability policies total, in excess of that. There's no discovery rule on contract claims like this. Policy clearly applied, and we have the Gamma Tau line of cases, which indicates, I believe going back about 96 years now, that when your contract is an insurance policy, the statute of limitations begins on the date of loss. I believe the law was interpreted somewhat in Eifert, where it was a UM policy, and at the time of the accident, and for the first several years, there was an insurance policy on the tortfeasor, so there could be no UM claim. But the policy defined UM to include an insurer who became insolvent. That happened in that case. So there was a UM claim. The court looked at these Gamma Tau line of cases, noted that there was also the general rule of law for general contracts, that the statute begins to run at the time of breach, discussed this a little bit, said we don't need to decide it because it's timely under either rule. So what we have here is a specific rule for insurance policies and a general rule for other contracts. Now, you've seen all the cases. You've seen all the arguments in the brief. They've been parsed up and down and sideways, and I would like now to step back and look at the forest and not the trees a little bit, which is I'd like to look at the public policy implications here. That has not been directly addressed to a great extent. If you look at the Eifert case, they attempted to do that, but let's take a look at what they did. They failed to recognize that under the general statute of limitations for general contracts, you won't have a statute of limitations if you apply it to first-party policies like UM and UIM. You're going to have a non-existent statute of limitations, or it's going to be in the hands of the plaintiff as to when it starts, which amounts to the same thing. They say that under the general rule, a demand for arbitration or a demand for coverage must be denied for the statute of limitations to run. Obviously, that means it's in the hands of the plaintiff when to make the demand. As we pointed out in our brief, literally they could wait 10 years, 20 years, or 30 years, and as to a statute of limitations, it would never even start to run until they made a claim and the insurance company said, for whatever reason, no.
Don't all insurance policies contain a notice of loss or notice, some sort of notice provision that would prevent that from occurring?
I believe that they usually contain a notice of occurrence and a notice of claim.
And usually that has an outer limit. It says you've got to do it within a reasonable time, and then there's usually an outer limit of 1 year or something like that.
Right. But basically that statute has no teeth to it. You can put somebody on notice that you have a claim, but if you don't file a summons and complaint, you have not commenced an action. The statute of limitations requires commencement of an action within that time. There's been a lot of argument.
Policy defense.
Pardon?
It would be a policy defense. It would be a defense. So if you, the statute of limitations, under your example, hasn't run, if 10 years later they've made a demand, but there you'd win the lawsuit because they didn't do it promptly.
That's correct, but if we tried to use an argument like that, we would have to show prejudice if it's more than 1 year that, you know, they were late giving the notice for more than 1 year. The insurance company has to show prejudice. Now, there's a presumption of prejudice then, but it's rebuttable. So, again, you don't have a hard and fast rule that cuts off good claims and bad claims, which is what a statute of limitations is supposed to do. In a statute of limitations, there's nothing about how, well, we gave you notice, even though we didn't file the summons and complaint within the time limited by law. And in a statute of limitations, you can't say, well, we gave you notice of the occurrence, we gave you notice of the claim, and you weren't prejudiced. The Eifert case talked about laches and estoppel. Again, that's not a statute of limitations or a substitute for a statute of limitations. The legislature says there is a statute of limitations for contracts, all contracts. That includes insurance policy contracts. The issue before this court is when does it start, not whether we should have one. As a matter of public policy, we all know there has to be one. The question is, what is the best public policy for this state? Should we say it starts at the time of the accident or when the insured first has the suable claim on the policy? As in Eifert, which might be a slightly different date, or perhaps in a Danbeck case, only after you've recovered the entire amount of the tortfeasor's policy? Or should we leave it in the hands of the plaintiff, which means there is no statute?
Well, let's look at the bigger picture. Plaintiff here is injured and has a 3-year time period from the date of the injury to sue the tortfeasor, right? And sued here, right? Was there a lawsuit here?
Yes, there was.
Okay. In the bigger picture, shouldn't the plaintiff bring in farmers there as the insurer under the uninsured or underinsured motorist provision?
I don't think so, Justice Anderson, because this
is the whole thing settled in one lawsuit, not two, everybody's there. You can cross-examine everybody or examine them. What's the matter with that?
Why don't we have a 3-year statute of limitations for UM and UIM? Because it's a contract claim. You allow the UM and UIM claim to go up to 6 years. You require them to sue the tortfeasor within 3 years. What about those other 3 years?
That's a general contract statute. You got a special insurance. I'm not saying they have to bring it in 3 years, but I'm saying if there's a lawsuit, maybe there wouldn't be a lawsuit. Maybe it had been settled out. If there's a lawsuit, why don't we say you got to bring you in?
Well, I think because the policy is a contract between two parties, and it basically says in there, you and I are going to agree if the tortfeasor is liable or not and what the damages are. And if you and I can't agree, the contract says we're going to arbitrate that issue. We're not going to go into court. Court is more expensive than arbitration. Typically, in arbitration, you still have a deposition of the plaintiff and maybe a treating doctor. But then everything is presented to the arbitrators in documentary form. There's very little live testimony in an arbitration proceeding.
Okay, so you're willing to allow the plaintiff to go ahead, sue the tortfeasor, and not to bring you in, right?
Okay. Yeah, particularly in a UIM case, because the issue of whether the damages exceed the tortfeasor's liability policy, that typically does not concern those parties as much as it does the UIM carrier. And, like I say, they've bargained to have arbitration decide that issue. And there's pros and cons to arbitration for both sides. It's cheaper. It's usually faster, quite a bit faster. And the other thing is, quite frankly, if you're a plaintiff on smaller cases, you'd rather arbitrate. You get more money from the arbitrators than you do from a jury on soft tissue injury cases.
So now we got this lawsuit going. It was filed, 2 months before the 3-year statute ended, and it's not determined until 6 years have now passed since the accident, and then there's an appeal. I know not this case, but I'm trying to figure out what happens.
But you can always.
And then they can't arbitrate with you, right? Because.
They can always file their summons and complaint. Any time within that 6 years, if they believe they have evidence that the damages exceed the tortfeasor's limit, and they can always ask for arbitration, and if they ask within the time, the insurance company should agree to it. They're bound to agree to it. And if you go into arbitration, it stays the statute of limitations. There's a specific statute on that, 631 point, I can't remember if it's 83 or point 43. Once you're in arbitration, you're preserved from the statute of limitations if you're the insured.
Well, that's the same thing as bringing you into the original lawsuit.
Well, it's not, because you have all the expense of litigation, and then when you're in a lawsuit, you have a three-cornered hat going on there. You've got the plaintiff suing the tortfeasor. You're kind of against the plaintiff and kind of against the tortfeasor. It's kind of a three-ring circus, and if you want to take a deposition of the plaintiff, for example, you've got to have this other guy's attorney in there asking questions and maybe screwing up your case. And that's why in the contract you specify, well, we're not going to do that. We're going to have a separate arbitration procedure.
Okay, so your position then, if I understand it, is the way it should work is plaintiff sues tortfeasor within the 3 years. Plaintiff sues you anytime within 6 years, can do it at the same time as he sues the tortfeasor.
I believe so.
Then sues you, and you've got two separate cases not to be consolidated.
Right.
That's
and
your
one
position.
Not involving the judicial system. There's no burden on the judicial system from the arbitration proceedings.
Oh, wait, but look, we got to get that lawsuit filed within 6 years. So we're going to file the lawsuit, and then if you guys want to arbitrate, you do it. But there's a stay of the...
If you file a suit, Justice Abramson, within the 6 years, I, as the defense attorney, unless it's a real small case, I'm going to move for a stay of proceedings to allow the arbitration.
Okay.
And then you've got the tolling statute.
Then I've got the what?
Tolling statute, so you don't have to worry.
But I'm saying that. So
it's not in court.
Well, it's in court. It's just not going to trial.
Right.
But it's in court. And that protects the statute of limitations. That's the forest. That's how you want these to proceed.
Yeah, I guess you looked at a bigger forest than I did there. You're thinking of judicial economy and things of that nature as well.
Oh, I'm trying to get the statute of limitations accommodated, and at the same time, we don't know what the damages are because we haven't finished the lawsuit with the tortfeasor.
Well, that's not quite correct, Justice Abramson. You know what your damages are. Every attorney who does personal injury cases, he can tell you pretty darn closely what his damages are. Now, there's some cases, like I've got a trial next week. Plaintiff says he's got a back annular tear in his back that came from the accident. We say, nah, your complaint started too long. There's cases like that. But in most cases, if you're the plaintiff's attorney, you know what your special damages are. You know what the injuries are. You know pretty darn well the ballpark range of what you're going to get. And you can tell the same way you evaluate that case in the personal injury case, you know when you make that same evaluation if it's more than their liability limits or not. And you have the 3 years to go out and sue the other party and get a copy of the policy by written discovery if you can't get it informally.
So when did you know that the damages here are going to be over $100,000?
I did not have the case originally on the third
and third attorney handling. Did Farmers know?
Farmers does not believe it was that much. We had a independent medical examination saying that whatever condition it was wasn't related, if I remember.
Wasn't right about that.
Was there a July 26, 1994 letter to Farmers advising them the claim was worth more than the limit? Sorry, Chief, I just...
That's their opinion. See, they think it's worth more than 100, and guess what? In this case, they were right. The arbitrators agreed with them. They knew that all along. When they filed their summons and complaint in the lawsuit, they said it was worth more than $100,000. We, as the defense attorneys, don't always agree with the plaintiffs. But they're the ones that have to evaluate and determine when they have to make a timely filing for a summons and complaint on a UM and a UAM case. And they're perfectly capable of doing that. And they do it all the time. There's not a problem there. In this case, they clearly knew that their damages exceeded not only the $50,000 limit for the one tortfeasor and the $50,000 for the other, so that they could have sued this one or this one for the whole thing. They knew it exceeded the total of both. It's right in their complaint.
Could I ask?
3 years.
Who should the plaintiff have sued first? The two tortfeasors or your company?
They could have sued them at the same time, Justice Prosser.
What's your answer? I didn't hear that.
They could have sued at the same time, and if they had, like I say, then it's a strategic decision for the insurance company. If it's a small case, you might want to keep it in court because juries are very hard on soft tissue injuries these days. If it's a bigger case, you want it in arbitration because the arbitrator is never going to give away your policy limit. That hardly ever, ever happens. So there's all kinds of things that go into this on the plaintiff side and the defense side as to tactics and what you want to do at what point in time. But these people knew that they had a UIM case when they filed their summons and complaint within 3 years of their accident. And that's the same thing I would tell you in any case.
Did these folks make a procedural mistake by suing the two tortfeasors first?
I would not say that they made a procedural mistake at all. That's the typical course, I think.
Well, if they didn't make a procedural mistake, then what about the Drake case?
I'm sorry, the Drake case? I don't think the Drake case is valid law at the time of this case. It may again come up because of statutory changes, but if I remember that case correctly, it was overruled by a statutory change. It was in effect at the time of this accident. I know I addressed it in a reply brief. Okay, they cited the Drake case, saying that there had to be a determination made in a suit or settlement with the tortfeasor's liability insurer as to legal liability and damages. That's not what Drake was all about. If you look at that case, there was an enforceable reducing clause at that time, which was more than the reducing clauses you can have now. The statute here allows them, but not like this one. This one said you had a $50,000 liability policy in Drake, and you had a $15,000 UM coverage policy. And back then, if you recovered the $50,000 liability policy, you could not recover the $15,000 because it was reduced dollar for dollar by the $50,000 you got. And that's why they said in that case, you can't sue the UM carrier if you've already sued the tortfeasor, because if you were going to recover from the tortfeasor in that case, unlike this case, you would never have a claim of any kind against the UM carrier. Your success there would preclude your success here. And so the Drake case said, we're not even going to let you file that case until you finish this one and find out. That's not like a UIM case. A UIM case can be filed independently. We don't have enforceable reducing clauses like that anymore. That was the basis for the Drake decision. I don't believe it applies anymore. But I would like to ask a question of the court, if I could be so bold. I have not seen one thing in the filings in this case, in the Court of Appeals, the trial court, or this court, that gives any public policy argument in favor of the Court of Appeals ruling. There's absolutely nothing there. The trial court said the Abramson Supreme Court case tied its hands and didn't say anything about it. The Court of Appeals said the same thing, didn't get into this at all. The respondents here don't give us any policy arguments at all, and I've asked again in my reply brief, why should the rule be that way? What good reason is there for a rule that would simply apply the same statute of limitations to insurance policies when they're so different?
Let me give you one. We had a judicial conference last week. One of the sections talked about pending cases and how long they're pending, and the judges ought to watch how long cases are pending. Apparently, your argument is that the plaintiff could file the day after the accident against your company and let the case simply sit around for another 6 years.
I don't think that would happen, Justice Prosser, because of this reason. I've had a few cases like that. I believe a couple of them are in Washington County. If you're the plaintiff and you do file your UIM case, they're going to set you on for a scheduling conference, okay? And then if I, as a defense lawyer, bring a motion and say I'd like a stay of proceedings pending the arbitration, that trial judge is going to say, that's fine, but you have that arbitration completed by, and he'll give you a deadline. And if you don't have it done, you're going to have trouble with the judge. So that case is not going to sit there for 6 years, in my experience. They're going to give you a reasonable deadline, almost the same thing as if you had filed a suit and they had given you their own scheduling order. They're going to say, well, you can have discovery and I want this done within 10 months or whatever.
How could the arbitration be complete if there hasn't been some sort of settlement with the tortfeasors, which in this case included your company?
Because it's an entirely separate determination made by the arbitrators. The arbitrators can decide. He didn't have to sue a tortfeasor at all. He could have, if he wanted to give up the underlying limits, I mean, he can't collect that on a UIM policy. He could have brought the claim against the UIM carrier. He could have let them rule what the amount of the damages are, just as they did. They said $200,000-some. So he collects that amount over whatever the collectible liability insurance was. And then he could have gone after this case and gone after the tortfeasor if he did it within 3 years.
How can you know what the value of the case is under arbitration in response to Justice Prosser's question until you have the end of the healing period? I mean, isn't the nature and extent of healing address the issue of the permanency of the disability? And the permanency of the disability is in large part what the case is worth.
Sure.
Future pain and suffering and disability. That's what you're arguing, that you should arbitrate the case and arbitration will give you the total value of the case years before you know what the case is worth because the healing period isn't complete.
Well, I'm not saying they have to do that. They can take the whole 6 years. And remember, that's double the statute of limitations they deal with on the court.
Well, let's take this case. I mean, if I recall correctly, in this case, there was healing period arguably wasn't until she had surgery and there was no permanency. Is this the right case? And there was no permanency evaluation by the doctor until after surgery, several months, I think, after surgery. So it perplexes me how you can argument can advance as a matter of law that the case of the value has to be arbitrated and a value arrived at prior to the end of the healing period.
Justice Bradley, you don't have to prove your case to file the case. A lot of people file cases in tort and contract and everything else that don't have a valid claim, and they lose on the merits if that's true.
Oh, yeah, listen, all we'll take you on.
The Abramson.
No, if you're going to file a frivolous case.
No, not frivolous. You just have to have enough there to think that you have damages that exceed the available tortfeasor's policy limits. You don't have to prove your case on the day you file it. You just have to have a good faith, reasonable belief that I'm having surgery. Everybody knows when you have surgery, by the way, that there's at least a minimal permanent partial disability just from having the surgery, and you've got a scar and things of that nature. So you know you've got some permanency going in. The only question is, to what extent is it? But that's the kind of issues that plaintiff's lawyers address all the time. They evaluate their case. They evaluated their case here, and they knew it was worth more than the 100,000 limits each time they filed it within 3 years. And if somebody has a particularly difficult situation like you're suggesting, that I'm going to suggest to you that if they request arbitration, like I say, the insurance company has to agree to the arbitration within the 6 years, or that's bad faith, which is a separate claim, a tort. You know, they can get punitive damages for that. If they request the arbitration, the arbitrators have it within their power, and this policy says it'll be conducted under the same procedure and same rules of evidence as a trial court. The arbitrators have it in their power to say, oh, you have had surgery? Well, we're going to just put this off, and you give us your permanency report when the healing plateau has ended. It's going to be the same thing as if you're in trial court. But you have to preserve your claim by filing your action within the statute of limitations or having the other party agree to arbitration within that time so you toll the statute. You've got to have a cutoff on claims. This case clearly illustrates what happens when you don't.
When is the cause of action accrue on the bad faith claim as set forth on the first cause of action, the plaintiff's
complaint? Well, that fell by the wayside in this case. As you know, it was barred and merged in the judgment, but bad faith typically arises when there has been, for example, a failure to investigate, failure to honestly evaluate a case, and that there's a intentional knowledge of that fact. It's a two-pronged test. Typically, like in this case, they claimed all along the damages were worth more than $100,000. If they could have proved both parts of those claims, they would have had a bad faith claim in addition, and it's a separate statute of limitations. If the tort occurs on the fifth year and the 364th day, you've got a two-year statute of limitations going 2 years into the future from that, and it's longer than the six-year statute here at that point. So I think they're fairly covered from any shenanigans by an insurance company late in the game.
But when did it accrue?
I'm sorry, could I say one more thing, Justice?
When does a bad faith claim accrue?
It accrues at the time the tort occurs, and it's a two-pronged test. They have to have not done something they should have done and known that they didn't do it properly. But in this case, if you look, they claim that the statute began to run when the insurance company denied their claim on the basis of the statute of limitations. And so, to them, the statute would not have run until 1993, 16 years after this accident. Thank you.
Could I ask you one other question, sir?
Yes, sir.
Your position is that the statute of limitations ran out 6 years after the accident, is that right?
In this particular case, it did, because we don't have a Danbeck language, and we don't have a situation like Eifert, where there was a UM policy, and you had an insurance company for the tortfeasor who then became insolvent. On insolvency, they then became an uninsured motorist.
And that 6 years would have been October 22nd, 1993.
1993.
Why didn't you inform the insured that the statute of limitations had run out until February 1997?
I wish I could answer that specifically for you, but I wasn't handling the case. That question has come to my mind, and I think the only answer I can give you is this. There was nothing that the insurance company did, and I don't see any claim that's been addressed to this court, that there's any estoppel on the part of the insurance company to raise that. In other words, I know there's a bunch of cases out there saying insurance companies have negotiated with somebody after the statute's run, the statute still has run, and you don't apply laches in that situation. It's only if you do something to them to make them think you're not going to apply the statute of limitations on their claim that you can claim laches. So I think that may be a irrelevant point, although I did wonder about that myself, quite frankly.
Well, does the insurance company have any obligation to advise the insured that this statute of limitations running?
I don't think they do when there's attorney involved, Justice Abramson. I mean, otherwise,
you can just lie in the weeds.
Where would you stop? No, not lie in the weeds. Where would you stop advising them of what the law is and what their rights are?
You can just let it ride and then claim the statute of limitations.
Represented by an attorney, I can't represent them, as you know.
Right.
Nobody in my office could represent the plaintiff and give them legal advice. I guess I don't see why the insurance company should be any different. If they didn't have an attorney, I think you'd have a good point. I think it would be appropriate then.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes to rebuttal. Mr. Ladwood?
And please, the court, fellow counsel. My name is William Ladwood, and Sharon Wiggins is at my side. And we're the attorneys for Lance and Karen Yoker. This case is presented to the court on the petition of the defendant in this action, Farmers Insurance. The case comes up from the Court of Appeals, whereby the court has determined that the statute of limitations in this action is a contract statute of limitation, and that it accrues from the date of the breach of contract. I thought going into this case that this was relatively a simple issue. And obviously, in the course of briefing this case, I have become absolutely amazed as to what the panoply of cases are across the country. It appears, as that we look at it, that a number of courts have looked at this situation. There have been four alternatives that, in fact, have been looked at with regard to determination as to when the accrual occurs. The first one is at the date of the accident itself. The second one is when the parties have either gone to judgment or have received a settlement from the tortfeasors. The third is when there has been a breach of contract. And the fourth is when there is statutory language or there is contractual language. Statutory language usually is a direct action statute, state, and or lack of direct action state. And contract language usually is where the parties have agreed that, in fact, this action has to be commenced within so many years after the accident are presented. In reviewing that theory of cases to this case, trying to sit down and do an intellectual development as to when the statute of limitations accrues, I think we have to look first at the contractual language that existed between the Yokers and Farmers Insurance, because I think this becomes tantamount to realizing how this action proceeds. In the language that exists in the contract, it indicates that no legal action can be brought against the insurance company until there is full compliance with regard to the terms and the conditions of the policy. That then indicates that you have to go through arbitration. Additionally, it indicates that, in this case, that you have to pay only after the limits of the liability under any applicable bodily injury liability bonds or policies have been exhausted by payment of judgment or settlements. So the question that any plaintiff's attorney has as they start out a case is, okay, I've got a cause of action. I have to file it within the 3 years. As Justice Sykes has indicated, there is a requirement that you have to notify the insurance company. This was done in this case on December 21st, 1987, when a letter was sent to them indicating that they were making claims for all damages that existed. What happened in this unique case was that the action was started. There was a bulging disc, eventually herniated, and eventually a laminectomy. We were in Washington County. The cases take a significant amount of time to be tried during that period of time. We came up for a court trial, and then what occurred is because of the laminectomy, we had to be set off for a period of time. During that period of time, eventually settlement occurred, but that was approximately 7 to 8 years later. At the time that the settlement occurred, the parties sat down, they discussed the issue with regard to it, and they entered into a release. That release reserved the right to proceed under Yoker's Farmers Insurance Policy under their underinsured motorist provision. All parties believed, I thought at that time, that in fact there existed a right to proceed under the underinsured motorist provision. And thereafter, discussions occurred, proceedings continued, an arbitrator was named, and eventually Farmers Insurance notified myself, indicating to me that in fact they would not proceed because they believed the statute of limitations had run, that it had run under the Gamma Tau theory of cases from the date of the accident. If you look at the Gamma Tau case, the date of the accident is not really the test. The test is the date of the loss, and the determination of what is the loss. If, in fact, you take the position under the first theory that it comes from the date of the accident, then you're saying that that loss occurred as a result of a tort, and that the statute or the contractual statute is really a quasi-contract. It's not a truly contract theory or a general contract statute limitation, because what you're saying is it's 6 years from the time that this accident occurred and that you had something that started your loss procedure. It's like the first step along a road. It is not the last significant event, but the first step. I think that that is probably an incorrect interpretation to say that. I think that with regard to it, what we have in an underinsured motorist provision is a true contract. There is statutory language that requires an uninsured motorist, but with regard to underinsured motorists, this is a contractual relationship that exists between the insurance company and the insurer, and it goes both ways. Counsel has indicated that we can name the time when we want to arbitrate. Well, clearly, if we've given them notice, they also have the ability to require arbitration at any time. They have the same rights as we have with regard to it. So that when we look at these contracts and the six-year statute of limitations, it seems to me that the loss is not at the time of the date of the accident. I believe that the second theory that I believe that a lot of courts have looked at is that the real loss occurs when there has either been a judgment or there's been a tendering of the amounts of monies that the tortfeasor has. Because it's at that point that you become aware that you, in fact, have not been made whole. Prior to that time, you don't know it. Counsel indicates the plaintiff knows how much damages may be. The answer is we do have a rough guess with regard to how much damages may be. But the language of the contract also indicates that these tortfeasors have to be liable. And in this state, we have contributory negligence. And part of the problem that we have is we are never sure what percentage of contributory negligence that might exist in these cases. So until we get to the point of time that we either have judgment or somebody has tendered the policies to us, we can't tell you to the exact dollar or even a general area as to what may occur. I can advise you, I felt very strongly in many cases and have been many times been wrong as a result of jury trials. And I've also been pleasantly surprised sometimes with regard to it. The procedure, the third procedure, is when there is a breach of that contract. And what occurred here, just so the court knows, we followed the procedure that we thought the Supreme Court had set forth. We followed the procedure that we started an action against the tortfeasor pursuant to the contract. We went ahead. We had tendered to us the policy limits. Prior to doing that, we followed the procedure in void. We advised them that we, in fact, have tendered the policy. If you want to step in at this time and be subrogated. If not, we are going to accept the monies, and then we're going to go after you. We looked at the Eifert case, and we felt and still feel that it complied with the requirements of Abrams and CL Associates, where it said that the last significant event that establishes a suable claim is when the breach occurs when there is a failure on the behalf of the insurance company to arbitrate. We felt that that was what occurred in this instance and that the statute of limitations would run from that time. I think this court has historically set forth that standard and has been telling plaintiff's attorneys that this is a standard to be used and that there is not a significant or a unique element of insurance contracts that puts them outside of the contractual statute of limitations. The very last one that is usually discussed is the statutory language or if it's by contract. And in conjunction with this case, I can advise you that I'm aware of no statute in the state of Wisconsin that sets forth a statute of limitations as to when it runs with regard to underinsured motorist provision. And I am not aware in this contract that there is any requirement in conjunction with that. So to direct my attention once more to the date of the accident and what I think occurs here and some of the questions I think seem to be implying is this. Counsel is indicating that at the time of the date of the accident, we have the right to sue the tortfeasors or we can sue, we can arbitrate this cause of action. And that if in fact they fail to arbitrate, we can then sue them. Even though at that time we are not aware of the amount of negligence, what insurance policies may be in existence. And part of the things that this court has to realize is insurance companies don't come along and tell us, hey, we have a $100,000 policy, we have a $50,000 policy. Many times they do. But they won't tell us that there's an umbrella policy. As we start investigating a case, we may find out that there's other liability there. These are things that ordinarily that are done under the normal course of these types of cases. Additionally, as Justice Abramson indicated, or Justice Bradley, we don't know what the extent of the injuries may be many times until we have proceeded along the way. In this case, we had a bulging disc, becomes herniated, becomes a laminectomy. These are situations that take time. And they developed during the course of this. And yet my client had contracted for underinsured motorist provision on three different vehicles, and she had the right to stack all those. She had over $750,000 worth of coverage with regard to these items. So she had a right to be able to look to this insurance company to cover her for those expenses as long as she followed it. One of the things that was proposed was that couldn't we file a lawsuit at the same time as we file an action against a tortfeasor? And I have thought of that problem often as I looked at this case because it's a logical question to ask. Shouldn't you automatically, any time that you have an action and you think that there's any possibility of an underinsured motorist provision, file an action with that? The problem is this. A, you got language that says you can't sue them until you've complied with the terms. And B, what happens if, in fact, you have a case that you don't know whether or not it is over the limits? You evaluate and you say it's only $90,000. It's only $80,000 at this time. Do I go ahead at that time and sue to stop the statute of limitations? And I'd like to do that. I'd like to say I'd like to start that lawsuit, stop the statute of limitations, so that I have some options down the road. But this court, and I believe it was in the Janner case, came along and said, if in fact you file an action that's frivolous, then you in fact can be held responsible for court costs. And I think that's a reasonable decision. But if in fact all you can come and do is say, hey, I have damages that are in excess of my policy limits, or I believe that, and I look at it and I have negligence that may be 40%, possibly 50 or 70%, am I opening up a whole scenario that says, hey, you filed a frivolous action, you should have never filed that, and so therefore you're going to be hit with costs. I think every plaintiff's attorney in the world would be worried about those types of situations. Additionally, the procedure that counsel has indicated would ordinarily occur is that you would file it. They would make a motion saying this action should be stayed for arbitration until after we have found out what the tortfeasor, in fact, may have with regard to an insurance coverage and how much money may be there. That requires an awful lot of additional court resources. It requires us to monitor a whole other set of actions that we have never had to do in this state before. We would have to look at all of these cases, and we would have to notify insurance companies, attorneys to come in. And the case is going on. You just sit there, or you don't take part, or whatever with regard to it. And it makes very little sense. Justice Prosser indicated that the Drake case was something that had some import, and I believe it does, because Drake case basically said, hey, many times if you file your action against the tortfeasor, you'll find out you don't have a claim, that you, in fact, are either going to recover from them, or if it was an underinsured motorist, that you will retain an amount of monies that will be less than what, in fact, you would have received under your own policy. And therefore, for the sake of judicial economy, and as a policy issue, it's something that we look at and we say to ourselves, hey, that makes sense. There is a common sense about that that says, first, find out what the tortfeasor has. Second, if in fact you haven't been made whole, go over here. So from our point of view, it seems to me that the statute of limitations is contractual, that the definition of accrued is what we have to look at here, that the definition of accrued says basically that the cause of action accrues on a date that damage is sustained and not the date when causes are set in motion which ultimately produce injury. As soon as a contract is breached, you have a suable claim. I think the Wisconsin Supreme Court has historically indicated that that is, in fact, the case. I personally and intellectually don't necessarily agree with it. I think that it is a more logical place for the statute of limitations to commence running is at that point in time when you have either been made whole, not made whole, but have received whatever amount of monies that the tortfeasor has tendered to you, or you have judgment. Because it is at that point that you know you have a loss. And it is at that point that there's an obligation for you to protect your rights. So even though I realize that the Supreme Court has certainly through the Abrams case, certainly through the Eifert case, led me to believe that it's a breach of contract. I do think the other one is a more logical. I can also indicate to you, as we have cited in our briefs, that the date of the accident is a minority view shared by a few states in this country. Most states apparently are equally divided between the two alternatives with regard to whether it occurs as of the date of the breach of the contract or as of the date when you have received the tortfeasor's monies or has been tendered to defense. So if there's any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Well, I have a question. So you go through and you get try a case and the your client is damaged $300,000, and that's what the jury says. Okay, and you collect $100,000 here. Now you're going to go after Farmers, and let's ignore the fact that Farmers is already in the case. And so you're going to sue them for whatever the policy limits are. Is Farmers now bound by the jury finding that you had $300,000 worth of damage?
That's an interesting point, Judge. And I have thought of that myself many times. The answer, apparently, as a result of the language, is no, because it goes through arbitration, and the arbitrators make that decision. On the other hand, I would suspect that that would probably be the best judge of what this case is worth.
Well, since the Farmers wasn't there, it's hard to bind them
that is correct.
On this. Now, can you bring under this policy a lawsuit before you arbitrate?
I don't see how, Judge. The language in the contract says you can't sue until you have complied with all the conditions, and one of the conditions
is you have to arbitrate. You view it as a condition precedent.
That is correct. I would.
And then on page 11, and you quote language from the policy, I didn't know the policy has been lost, apparently. Not available.
That is correct, Judge.
You will pay under this coverage only after the limits of liability under any applicable injury policy have been exhausted by payment or judgment. Do you view that they won't pay before then?
That is my understanding, that that's a condition precedent, that that is one of the requirements you have. Pardon me?
Isn't that a pretty standard clause?
That is a very standard clause.
When did you first make a claim against Farmers?
The first claim was on 12/21/87. That was a letter that was sent to Farmers Insurance Company making claim for all damages that were incurred by our client.
Oh, wasn't that claim a little bit ambiguous? I mean,
absolutely, Judge. Absolutely. And it's something that's pretty common to be done. And the reason why is at this stage, you're within a month of the accident, you don't know what specifically all your damages are going to be. But as Justice Sykes has indicated, you are required under the terms to advise them that an accident has occurred. Now, when specifically is there a claim later on made as to under the underinsured motorist, that goes into the summer prior to the agreement of the settlement occurring. And that would have been in the summer of 94. And at that time, we advised them that we were making a claim. They did not respond. We advised them again and said, we're going to accept the monies. And I think the court has to realize that there's somewhat of a problem here because Farmers is also the person who's tendering us the money. So we're going through what I think is something of a question of futility. I am sending letters to Farmers saying, you're going to give me this money. And I'm telling you now I'd like to accept this money, but you tell me if you don't want to and you want to step in and go after them. And one of the things that I have failed to mention is the other part of my argument in my brief, which basically goes to the issue whether or not the statute of limitations was told during this period of time. If the court would accept a 6-year statute of limitations and say it comes from the date of the accident, then it's my belief that the tolling statute should occur, because what the court would be indicating is that this contract really arises out of the tort, and it arises out of the cause of action as to whether or not there's any liability over and above the claim against the tortfeasor. Since Farmers, and maybe it was fortuitous, was part of this action, it seems to me that that toll, that statute of limitations for that approximately 5 to 6 years prior to an actual resolution with regard to it. Thereafter, we went into arbitration. The statute with regard to arbitration indicates that you toll it during the period of arbitration or an assessment or an appraisal, either as controlled by the contract or as agreed to between the parties. And it was very clear to me that at least as long as we had Farmers agreeing that we could reserve our rights under the insurance policy, that this arbitration procedure was what they were going along with at the same time. And it was something that there was a tacit agreement. Now, was there ever anything in writing? No, there wasn't. But certainly, went through the action. We entered into a settlement agreement whereby they said, in fact, you can reserve your rights to go under the underinsurance motorist provision. We started negotiations. We name our arbitrator, and then they turn around and they say, hey, but we're not going to, in fact, proceed. And the last area is whether or not, this is a fetch, and I will be very honest with regard to it, as to whether or not 893.12 would in fact apply. And that says if there's advance payment of damages, that a limitation is extended. And it basically says that if a payment is made It shall be either the period of statute of limitations shall be either the period of time remaining under the original statute of limitations or 3 years from the date of the last payment made. And it's got to be a payment made on the question of liability. If, in fact, this is a contract action that arises out of the tort and it has the nature of this quasi-contract, then it seems to me when they made the settlement on behalf of the tortfeasor, without advising us as to whether or not they were doing it on a subrogation claim or whether it was under a tortfeasor, that, in fact, this is under an omission of liability, and that, therefore, we would have 3 years from that date of the entering into that release. And I would agree wholeheartedly with the court that that is probably a reach. But I don't know what this court is going to do with that whole issue as to whether or not we have a tort, a contract, or do we have some other type of animal. So just because it's an insurance policy, is it something else other than what we normally put in those two categories?
If you were writing the opinion in this case, how would you describe the statute of limitations on insurance contracts after the decision?
And I have thought of that question a great deal. And that's part of the reason why I don't necessarily agree with what the court has indicated in the past, saying that it comes from the breach. It seems to me that theory of cases on gamma tau that indicates that it comes from the date of loss has a certain amount of desirability. Why? Because if, in fact, you know that you have experienced a loss, you can't just sit around and do nothing in conjunction with it. You have to do something. Now, the problem becomes, when is that date of loss? And to me, that date of loss is under the terms of this contract, when I, in fact, have either had tendered to me the monies from the tortfeasor, or if I have a judgment and I've collected the monies, I know that I have a loss at that time. And thereafter, it seems to me, that would be when the statute of limitations would run. I think intellectually, being honest, I think that's it. I, however, do not believe that it's necessary to follow that opinion. And I don't think the court, Supreme Court here has ever done that. I think they have looked upon this as a true contract. It's an insurance contract, and it isn't handled any differently than any other contract. And the last suable event, or the last event, significant event that creates a suable right is when that breach of contract occurs. And there are many states that follow that. And it certainly is also intellectually honest.
All of which protect your client's claim.
That's correct, Judge. That's correct. Anything else? Thank you.
Coincidentally.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions for counsel?
No.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ladwick. Mr. Carroll?
Thank you. I think we can't lose sight of the fact that the courts have already held this is a contract claim. It's not a tort claim. We can talk about quasi-contract probably all we want to, but the court has already held that somebody like my client cannot get up there and say, oh, three-year statutes run, don't make a claim against us now, because it's a contract claim, not a quasi-contract claim, a contract claim.
Mr. Carroll, I'm going to ask you a very unfair question. Give me all the equities in favor of the insurance company here.
Should we talk about the equities in favor of an insurance company who's presented with a claim, or just this insurance company? Just
under the facts of this case, I mean, you had the insurance company in two different roles here.
Right.
You had the insurance company getting notice before a settlement. You had the insurance company, your insurance company, apparently agreeing to in the settlement, you participated and they reserved their rights. And you knew about this through the insured from a few days after the accident. Now give me the equities of why you should win on these facts.
Well, if we want to talk about the equities of this particular company because of the coincidence that it was also a tortfeasor's liability carrier, I think they're there. I think we can't forget that whatever rule this court's going to put in this case is going to apply to other companies. This is a very unusual situation. It happens from time to time. I don't think very often. Okay, but let's address that. Those letters, we addressed that in the footnote on page 8 of our blue brief. It wasn't until July 26, 1994, that they made a first reference to UIM at all to this insurance company. That's the record. And that was after the statute of limitations had passed by, 6 years and 8 months after the accident. And that wasn't even saying they were making a UIM claim. It said a claim may be made. I just quoted that. The first time they said they were making a claim is a letter on February 13, 1995. It says, I am now making demand to you under underinsured motorist policy. Now, these folks could have protected themselves by filing the suit within the 6 years or demanding arbitration. And if you look in the policy, it's on page 182 in the appendix. If they don't agree with each other, in the event they don't agree, the insured person will select an arbitrator and we will select another. The two will select a third. When does the record show the plaintiffs ever selected an arbitrator and wrote or even called this insurance company and said, we want to arbitrate this? It was after our motion was denied by the trial court, about 9 years after the accident, approximately. They could have done that. There's no reason they couldn't have done that. They knew when they filed that first lawsuit against the tortfeasor and this same insurance company, coincidentally, that their damages were in excess of $100,000. And all they had to do was know that they were in excess of $50,000 to make this claim.
But even under that circumstance, though, isn't the claim against the UIM carrier only contingent until there's an exhaustion?
I don't believe it's contingent at all, Justice Sykes. Because
there is no duty to pay until exhaustion
No, there's no Danbeck language in this case. Now, they cited a 1989 Ford policy. That's a fugitive in the record. Their own complaint says Farmers never gave them a policy for a 1989 Ford. I'm wondering where that one in the affidavit came from if it didn't come from Farmers. If you look at that, there's two policies that we had. One was in 87, and I forget what the other one was. They have the policy coverage here is in a, I believe it's in the policy jacket. That other fugitive policy that they claim they didn't get from us in their own complaint gives the coverage in an endorsement that came in 5 years later in 1992. It's first edition, March 1992, right on the form. So the Danbeck language is not in this case.
Or
if it were, they might have an argument here. I would agree with that.
Is there a factual dispute over whether there was an exhaustion clause applicable here?
I don't think it is, because the record doesn't show it exists. There's something in there attached to an affidavit of counsel for the respondents here, but the complaint says he didn't get it from the insurance company. He calls it a reconstruction. Well, who reconstructed it is my question. The insurance company didn't do it. They said in their brief here that we admitted to it, and I gave you in the supplemental appendix in our gray brief there a copy of our answer, and we denied that there was any policy on a 1989 Ford. It's a fugitive in this record, and it's definitely something that came in 1992. There was another case I had with this court, wish I could recall the name of it, involved the same issue. I don't know if this court can take judicial notice of its prior cases. If I can remember that case, you'll see all the affidavits in there about how that 1179 endorsement wasn't even printed until March of 1992 by the printer. This accident was in 1987.
Isn't it a common insurance policy?
No, the Danbeck language was not that common at the time of this accident. I believe it's pretty common today.
Right. Now it is.
Right. And if you have a Danbeck policy, I would think probably you're right.
It's a contingent claim only until
exhaustion. Well, there's two arguments to be made there, and maybe the court should wait until they get a Danbeck policy, because I can see an argument being made, well, you told us that we can't come after you until we collect, and the court has recently enforced that language in Danbeck. On the other hand, the Gamma Tau case says, if that is a condition precedent, and I don't think it is, I think Gamma Tau says you know, complying fully with the policy is not a condition precedent to suit. They claim it is, and that's why they didn't file suit. I think you can make that same argument for the Danbeck language. I think there's two sides to that issue as well. I perhaps think that maybe if the Danbeck language was in this case, the best of the argument would be on start the statute of limitations then, but that's not before this court, I don't believe. Thank you.
Any other questions, Mr. Carroll? Thank you, Mr. Carroll. Thank you, Mr. Ladwick. That concludes our hearing 00-D.